No one was cursing or sweating. The stovetops, cutting boards, counter space, cook's whites, even the aprons were spotless at 8:30 on a Friday night. Each sauce and salad, each item was tasted by the person preparing it, each and every time. Three orders of veal cheek special came up at the same time. They were absolutely identical. At Leal, I go through a 10-pound bag of shallots every day, so it was truly jarring to see Scott Bryan's mise en place. The shallots on station were not chopped. They weren't robot cooped either. They were brunoised. Every tiny little piece, uniform, textbook, perfectly squared off and nearly subatomic in dimensions. The chopped chives were the same. Not a thread, not a single errant or irregular shred, every one the size of a cloned single-celled organism. The whole kitchen smelled of truffles. Two thumb-sized knobs of the wildly expensive fungus sat by the garnish tray where Scott would shave them onto outgoing orders. Truffle oil was being poured into pans like I use olive oil. Sauces were being mounted with foie gras and Normandy butter. And everything, everything was being made to order. Risotto, out of the box and into the pot, from scratch. A tiny young woman worked at a corner station, and I made the immediate Neanderthal assumption as I first took in the crew. Extern, maybe from Peter Kump or French Culinary, having a learning experience dishing out veggies. I passed right over her as I swept my eyes down the line looking for the heavy hitters. In time, I began peripherally to become aware of her movements. I looked again, closer this time, and saw that she was plating fish, cooking risotto, emulsifying sauces, taking on three, then four, then five orders at a time, all the while never changing expression or showing any visible signs of frustration or exasperation, as I would have under similar circumstances. No worries, just smooth, practiced motions, moves you see in 20-year veterans, no pot grabbed without a side towel, no wasted effort, every sauce getting a quick taste, correcting seasonings, coming up on her stuff at the same time as the rest of the order, generally holding down her end like an ass-kicking, name-taking mercenary of the old school, only cleaner and better. Her station and her uniform were absolutely unmarked by spills, stains, or any of the expected Friday night detritus. "Where did she come from?" I whispered to Scott. Not amazed that a woman could do the job, but that anyone other than a 35-year-old Ecuadorian mercenary could do it so stone-cold. Remember what I said about Americans versus Mis Carnales from Point South? Wrong again. "Oh, her," said Scott casually, "Alain Ducasse," mentioning God's name as breezily as I'd say the Hilton or Houlihan's. If this sobering revelation wasn't painful enough, if I wasn't choking down enough crow, there was some more humble pie to come. A waiter came in with a half-empty bottle of wine, a 1989 Le Chambertin, and handed it to the Dominican dishwasher. At this point, I was ready to answer one of those ads in the paper for learn how to drive the big rigs, maybe take up mink ranching. Anyway, the grateful dishwasher examined the bottle for sediment, promptly decanted the remains, poured some wine into a stem glass, which he held knowledgeably between two fingers by the stem, and then swirled, examining the ropes with a discerning eye before taking an airy slurp. I was ready to hit myself hard with the nearest blunt object. Oh yeah, the food. Luxurious but austere. Bluefin tuna tartare with pickled cucumbers, lime, chili, and lemongrass was formed by hand. Unlike a lot of his peers, Scott doesn't like torturing food into unnatural shapes so it looks like something else. Metal rings, remember? You might want to reconsider what I said about them, too. Green and white asparagus were spooned with chanterelle and truffle fondue. Chilled lobster was stacked on fava bean puree and drizzled with Ligurian olive oil. Even the green salads were hand-picked, one leaf after the other piled gently on the plate, the garde-manger guy tasting the occasional piece. A filet mignon came up in the window with a medallion of bone marrow looking pretty and pink under a thin veneer of sauce. And Scott still doesn't make veal stock. There was tête de porc en crépinette, monkfish with white beans, lardon, roasted tomato, and picholines, diver scallops with pea shoots, black truffle vinaigrette, and truffle chive potato puree. Scottish salmon hit the pass-through with chestnut honey-glazed onions, old sherry wine vinegar, and chicken jus. Not a damn thing to sneer at. That I do more meals at Leal in 45 minutes than Scott does all night was cold comfort. The food was also dead-bang honest. No bogus wild weed infusions, cookie-cutter piles of pre-made garnishes, no paper collars used to force food into tumescence. Garnishes, such as they were edible. The food looked good without them. And the plates were white. No SB logo, no multicolored spirals, Baroque patterns, oddball novelty shapes, football field sizes, or ozone layer puncturing space needles of verticality. The pâtissier whacked off a hunk of Morbier for a cheese plate. A daring selection. Touch that stuff, you'll be sniffing your fingers for a week. Bread was from Amy's along with a rustic ciabatta. When orders came in faster, the pace quickened slightly, but nobody ran. Nobody seemed hurried. Scott jumped from station to station as his mood dictated. Fish, sauté, garde-manger, even pastry. In his absence, waiters wordlessly stepped in and did the expediting and plate finishing with imperceptible change in product. Waiters shouldn't touch food. Did I say that? Wrong again. Is everybody getting their food on time, I wondered. Everyone is so damn calm and collected in here that maybe it's chaos outside, a herd of pissed-off diners glaring silently at their waiters and wondering where their chow is, waiting for that maid to order risotto so the rest of the order can come up. I decided to see. No such luck. Outside the dining room was as relaxed as the kitchen, nothing but happy faces lingering over appetizers, sipping wine, expressions those of anticipating first-time lovers who just know they're going to be good together. The bar was packed with monomaniacal wine aficionados, poring over the 1,400-strong wine list like Talmudic scholars, beakers, glasses, decanters, laid out in front of them, making them look like well-dressed Dr. Frankensteins. They had a lot to ponder. The Veritas list is an imposing volume with a very reasonable range of wines from $18,000 to $25,000. I asked the bartender, hopefully, if any of these wine wonks ever got into it over the relative merits of, say, Côte d'Aron versus Bordeaux or 95 or 98. Anybody ever take a poke at another guy, duke it out over grape varieties, drunken brawls over topsoil, irrigation, drink now or drink later? Nope. All is calm. Pleasure rules. Listening to the customer talking seriously, really seriously about wine, I find yet another reason why Scott is a three-star chef and I'm not. I know almost nothing about wine. I'm not immune to the charms of wine. I've lived around it, enjoyed it, cooked with it all my life. I'm not entirely ignorant on the subject, nor am I dismissive of its importance. I still remember vividly heading off to the vintner in Bordeaux with my Uncle Gustave to get our empty bottles refilled with Vin Ordinaire from those giant casks. I could tell the difference between good wine, bad wine, and great wine. I have a pretty good working knowledge of the wine-producing regions of France and Italy. I'm vaguely aware that California seems to produce drinkable product these days, but I couldn't tell you grape variety with any more assurance than I could talk about stamp collecting or phrenology. And to be truthful, I've always felt that I've survived enough dangerous obsessions in my life. The knowledgeable appreciation of fine wine has always seemed to me to hold potential for becoming yet another consuming habit, an expensive one. When you know what it's like to squat on a blanket on Upper Broadway in the snow, selling off a lifetime's accumulation of rare books, records, and comic books for drugs, the idea of spending next week's paycheck on a bottle of red seems like, well, something that I probably shouldn't be doing. So even though I've been gushing here about Veritas and all things Brian, I'm really doing the place a disservice. The menu, the business, the whole concept of Veritas is built around the wine, a formidable cellar put together by two of the premium collector connoisseurs in the universe. It should be pointed out that Scott's food at Veritas is designed to complement that wine. I can only imagine that it does. The fish dishes are unusually hearty, good with red for the most part, I believe. Don't trust me on this. And the meat and poultry dishes are constructed and refined to match up nicely with the list. Some of the Asian seasonings and ingredients of early Brian have been dispensed with in order to best accomplish that mission. As for me, I drink beer and vodka when I eat at Veritas, preferring to spend my lucre on what I know to be good, namely the food. I know that's a lot like going to Egypt and not bothering to look at the pyramids, but hey, I'm just an old-time cookie with a chip on my shoulder and a heart full of envy. Problem is, Scott's an old-time cookie, too. After the kitchen closed at 10:45, they were talking about getting the last orders in. I took him up to the Siberia bar, down the subway steps, through the platform-level bar, and into the downstairs annex. I was hoping to get him drunk, find something to dislike about the miserable bastard who's so much better than me. Maybe I could get him sloshed. He'd start venting, make injudicious comments about some of those culinary heroes he'd worked for in the past. I mentioned I'd eaten at Le Bernardin recently, the full-bore chef tasting. An eyebrow went up. Oh, yeah? What did you have? When I told him, he looked happy, like I get when describing my first oyster. You have the mackerel tartare, dude? He asked. Yeah, I said, hesitating. It was good. Really good. Yes, it's got it. It is good, isn't it? What else did you have? I told him. The two of us talking about menus like some people talk about the Miracle Mets or the Koufax-era Dodgers. Who's making food these days that interests you, I asked. Well, let's see. Tom Colicchio at Gramercy Tavern. Tom makes really good food. And Rocco Despirito at Union Pacific is doing really interesting stuff. Have you seen this foam guy's shit, I asked, talking about Ferran Adria's restaurant of the minute, El Bulli, in Spain. That foam guy is bogus, he smirked. I ate there, dude, and it's like shock value. I had seawater sorbet. That was about as much bad-mouthing as I could get out of him. I wanted to know what he likes to eat. You know, after hours, you're half in the bag and you get hungry. What do you want to eat? Beef bourguignon, he said right away. I have found common ground. Red wine, beef, some button mushrooms and a few pearled onions, bouquet garni, maybe some broad noodles or a simple boiled potato or two to go with it, a crust of bread to soak up the sauce. Maybe I'm not wrong about everything. All cooks are sentimental fools. And in the end, maybe it is all about the food. Mission to Tokyo. If there was any justice in this world, I would have been a dead man at least two times over. By this I mean simply that many times in my life, the statistical probabilities of a fatal outcome have been overwhelming, thanks to my sins of excess and poor judgment and my inability to say no to anything that sounded as if it might have been fun. By all rights, I should have been, at various times, shot to death, stabbed to death, imprisoned for a significant period of time, or at the very least, victimized by a cassava-sized tumor. I often use the hypothetical out-of-control ice cream truck. What would happen if you were walking across the street and were suddenly hit by a careening Mr. Softy truck? As you lie there in your last few moments of consciousness, what kind of final regrets flash through your mind? I should have had a last cigarette, might be one. Or I should have dropped acid with everybody else back in 74. Maybe I should have done that hostess after all. Something along the lines of, I should have had more fun in my life. I should have relaxed a little more, enjoyed myself a little more. That was never my problem. With their yanking a fender out of my chest cavity, I will decidedly not be regretting missed opportunities for a good time. My regrets will be more along the lines of a sad list of people hurt, people let down, assets wasted, and advantages squandered. I'm still here, and I'm surprised by that, every day. So in the spring of 1999, I really and truly thought that I had had all my great adventures, that the entertainment and excitement segment of the program was long over. Been there and done that was more than an assumption for me. It was a defensive stance, and one that kept me and keeps me from repeating the stupid mistakes of the past. Sure, there were things to learn. I learned things all the time. But I'm talking about eye-opening, revelatory, perspective-altering life experiences. The exotic, the frightening, the totally new. I wasn't about to sample any new experimental hallucinogens at age 43. I wasn't going to submerge myself in some new criminal subculture, steeping myself in the customs and practices of professional gamblers, heroin seekers, or sexual adventurers, though at one time it would have greatly appealed to me. I didn't think I'd be shipping out on a great big clipper ship, as Lou Reed puts it, wandering the back streets of Peshawar or sampling live monkey brain in the Golden Triangle. My personal journey, I thought, was pretty much over. I was comfortably ensconced in secure digs with a wife who still, remarkably, found me to be amusing on occasion. I had a job I loved in a successful restaurant, and I was alive, for Christ's sakes. I was still around. Though the game had long since gone into overtime, I still had a few moves left in me, and I was content to play them out where I'd started, New York City, the place I believed heart and soul to be the center of the world. So it came as a surprise when one of the two partners at Leal, Philippe Lajoni, a man I barely conversed with up to that time, approached me one spring afternoon and said, "Chef, we'd like you to go to Tokyo. Make the food look and taste like it does in New York." Now, Brasserie Leal is a much-loved New York institution serving authentic French working man's fare to hordes of diners each night. I'm an American, whatever my lineage, so it threw me off guard to be asked if I'd go halfway around the world to consult and advise a French chef in Japan on the fine points of cassoulet, navarin d'agneau, frisé au lardon, and boudin noir at Leal, Tokyo. But my masters Philippe, a Frenchman, and José de Mireles, a Portuguese francophile, seemed convinced enough of my mystical connection to the food they clearly adore to pack me onto a plane and send me jetting off to Tokyo for a week. It was a daunting and unusual assignment, and I was going alone. My wife would not be joining me. My biggest concern was the flight. 14 hours in the air, and no smoking. I scored some Valium before leaving for the airport, thinking maybe I could knock myself out and sleep through the ordeal. Unfortunately, as my Israeli-navigated town car swung into the Kennedy Airport environs, I couldn't find the damn pills. I tore frantically through my pockets and carry-on luggage, near tears, cursing myself, my wife, God, and everybody else who might be responsible for this hideous situation. I checked my knives through, not wanting to carry them on, and was soon dug in at 11 a.m. at the bar by the departure gate, last stop for degenerate smokers. My companions were a very unhappy-looking bunch of Asia veterans. Like me, they were chain-smoking and drinking beer with grim, determined expressions on their faces. A Chinese gentleman next to me, apropos of nothing, shook his head, blew smoke out of his nose, and said, "Sleeping pill. Only thing to do is sleep. 14 hours to Narita. Long time." This did not improve my mood. Another bar customer, an MP headed to South Korea to pick up a prisoner, slammed back another draft, and described the horror of business class to the other side of the world. He too shook his head, lips pursed, resigned to his fate. A red-faced Aussie with a 5-hour layover waiting for him on the Tokyo end advised me to have another beer, at least. Or three, mate. Nothing to do but bloody sleep. Yeah, right, I thought. Got any Demerol? As a backup, I'd acquired a few nicotine patches. I rolled up my left sleeve and slapped one directly over a vein, hoping for the best as they sounded final boarding. The flight was endless. The in-flight movie was a slight improvement over Looking Out the Window, a Japanese film about, as best as I could gather, fly fishing. Guys standing around in waders, philosophizing about carp in a language I couldn't understand, had a pleasantly somnolent effect, and I managed, with the help of many more beers, to pass out for a few hours. I should point out, by the way, that I know nothing about Japan. Oh, sure, I've seen The Seven Samurai and Rashomon and Yojimbo and the Kurosawa Policiers and Sonny Chiba and Ghidra vs. Mechagodzilla, for that matter, but I was in every significant way ignorant of all things Japanese. I knew only enough about Japanese culture and history to know that I knew nothing. I spoke not a word of Japanese. I had, with only a week's warning before my trip, not even acquired a guidebook or a street map for the city of Tokyo. But I did like sushi and sashimi. The city of Tokyo is an amazing sprawl, something out of William Gibson or Philip Dick, seeming to go on forever. The bus from the airport wound over bridges, down through tunnels, up flyovers that wrapped around the upper floors of apartment and office buildings. I passed canals, industrial parks, factories, residential areas, business districts, carp ponds, austere temples, indoor ski slopes, rooftop driving ranges. As I got closer to my destination, it was getting dark, with giant screaming video screens advertising beverages and cell phones and recording artists, garish signs in English and Japanese, lines of cars, crowds of people, row after row after row of them surging through intersections in orderly fashion. This was not America, or any place remotely like it. Things on the other side of the world were very, very different. The bus unloaded at a hotel in Roppongi District, and a helpful dispatcher in a uniform hailed me a cab. The rear passenger door swung open for me, operated by the driver by lever, and I slid onto a clean, white slip-covered back seat. Dispatcher and driver examined the layout business card with address, debating route and destination. When the matter was decided, the door swung closed, and we were off. The driver wore white gloves. Roppongi District is international in character, like an Asian Georgetown, and Layal Tokyo, located in the shadow of the Eiffel-like Tokyo Tower and across the street from a pachinko parlor, looked much like its older brother in New York, though spanking new and impeccably surgically clean. Layal New York is loved for its smoke-stained walls, creaky chairs, weathered wooden bar, the fact that it resembles what it is, a familiar, worn, old-school brasserie of the Parisian model. Layal Tokyo, on the other hand, though accurate to the model down to the tiniest design detail, was shiny and undamaged, and apparently kept that way. It was a warm night when I arrived, and the French doors to the café were opened. Philippe saw me from the bar. He'd arrived a day earlier. He came out to greet me. "Welcome to Tokyo, chef," he said. I had been provided with an apartment nearby, and Philippe helped load my luggage on the handlebars of two borrowed bicycles for the short trip over. My first close-up look at Tokyo was from the seat of a rickety three-gear as I pedaled furiously to keep up with Philippe. He took off at a good pace down Roppongi's very crowded streets. You're supposed to ride on the sidewalks, I later learned, though I don't know how that's even possible. Traffic runs the wrong way over there, so, heading straight into it, I picked and wove my way between cars and vans, dodging pedestrians, trying to keep my 50-pound duffel bag on the handlebars and not get dragged backwards off the seat by the other bag hanging around my neck. Roppongi Crossing, though by no means Tokyo's largest or busiest intersection, is where thousands of teenagers meet before heading off to the bars and clubs. The streets were unbelievably dense with pedestrians, people hanging around, flashing neon, flapping banners, more screaming signs, pimpy-looking young men in suits and patent leather shoes surrounded by dye-blonde Asian women in thigh-high boots and micro-miniskirts. Philippe took a hard turn and we were heading down a hill through twisting, narrow, and decidedly quieter streets. Things became stranger and even more unfamiliar, the smell of something good to eat issuing from every building as we passed. The organization kept a few apartments in a kind of residential hotel. It looked like a hotel, felt like a hotel, but had no visible employees. Comfortable, spacious by my imagined Tokyo standards, and equipped with cable TV, phone, fax, kitchenette, and ingeniously designed bathroom, I was soon unpacked and agreeably installed, my mysterious French boss staying next door. "I'm sure you want to shower, maybe rest for a while," said Philippe before heading back to Layal. "Can you find your way to the restaurant?" I was pretty sure I could. After a long shower and the short, deep apartment bathtub, I managed to find my way back to Layal, where I was shown around and introduced. Frederic Mardel was the chef from Aquitaine by way of Bora Bora. His chefs de partie, Hiroyoshi Baba of Japan, Delmas Sumeda Eliptia of Sri Lanka, and Mokoko of Myanmar were gracious in the extreme. Fortunately, the common language in the kitchen was French, which I found to my surprise that I could still speak and understand. I had been worried about this moment. I'd been apprehensive about invading another chef's kitchen. We tend to get our backs up with the arrival of interlopers, and though it may have been nice to be held up as some sort of benchmark for the Layal organization, I knew how I'd have felt if the chef from, say, Washington or Miami branch came swanning into my kitchen wanting to show me how the big boys do it. Frederic was a friendly and gracious host, however, and like the rest of the crew, had never been to New York. I was a curiosity, as strange to them as they were to me. The kitchen was small and spotless, with dangerously low range hoods for a 6'4" guy like me. A great covered canal ran around the floor beneath each station, with a current of constantly flowing water washing away any detritus that might fall from cutting boards. Containers were all space-saving square in shape, and the counters were low to the ground. I put on my whites, unwrapped my knives, and hung around the kitchen for a while, watching food go out, taking it all in, making small talk with the crew, aware of a persistent throbbing behind my eyes, an unpleasant constriction around my temples, a feeling that I was somehow not getting enough oxygen. Beat from the flight, I only stayed a few hours that night until at 10 p.m. Tokyo time, my brain thoroughly poached with jet lag, I slunk back to the apartment to collapse. I woke up at 5 a.m. hungry, put on a pullover, long-sleeve t-shirt, jeans, black elkskin cowboy boots that had seen better days, and a suit-cut leather jacket that Stephen had picked up used for me at a flea market. I was ready for adventure. Breakfast. At first, I didn't have the nerve. I wandered Roppongi's early morning streets, tortured by the delicious smells emanating from the many businessmen's noodle shops, intimidated by the crowds. Japanese salarymen sat cheek to jowl, happily slurping down bowls of soba. I didn't want to stare. I didn't want to offend. I was acutely aware of how freakish and un-Japanese I looked with my height and my boots and leather jacket. The prospect of pushing aside the banner to one of these places, sliding back the door and stepping inside, then squeezing onto a stool at a packed counter and trying to figure out how and what to order, was a little frightening. One couldn't enter a place, change one's mind, and then creep away. The prospect of being the center of attention at this tender hour, with the capillaries in my brain shriveled from all the beers on the flight, and the jet lag even worse than it had been the day before, I just couldn't handle it. I wandered the streets, gaping, my stomach growling, looking for somewhere, anywhere to sit down and have a coffee, something to eat. God help me, I settled for Starbucks. At least I saw from the street they allowed smoking. It was drizzling outside by now, and I was grateful for the refuge, if ashamed of myself. I sipped coffee. When I ordered it, the counter help repeated the order to one another at ear-splitting volume. Triple latte! Hi! One triple latte! I sat by the window, head-pounding, smoking, and sipping, summoning the courage for another pass at a soba joint. There was no way, I told myself, that I was going to eat my first Tokyo meal in Starbucks. Pinned under the wheels of that hypothetical Mr. Softy truck, I would have something to regret. Muttering to myself, I charged out of Starbucks, found the narrowest, most uninviting-looking street, pushed aside the banner of the first soba shop I encountered, slid back the door, and plopped myself down on a stool. When greeted, I simply pointed a thumb at the guy next to me and said, "Dozo, I'll have what he's having." Things worked out well. I was soon slurping happily away at a big steaming bowl of noodles, pork, rice, and pickles. This method of ordering would become my modus operandi over the following days and nights. And I can tell you that I felt a lot better about myself after my breakfast. I spent a few hours at the restaurant before hailing a cab for Chiyoda-ku District. I had an engagement. If you didn't already know, a few years back I wrote a satirical thriller, Policier, set predictably in the restaurant business. Based loosely on my experiences at Work Progress and with the Italian fraternal organization I mentioned earlier, it was acquired for translation by the eminent Japanese publishing house Hayakawa. Being the hustler that I am, upon learning I was headed for Tokyo, I immediately contacted my Japanese publisher, volunteering, a bit disingenuously, to do anything I could to help promote the book over there. I don't know how nice or how welcome a thing to do it was. The book had been out for a while and clearly had not set the world on fire. David Hasselhoff might have hit it big over there. Airwolf reruns were once huge on the Pacific Rim, but my little book had not, I think, caused my publishers to send for me to satisfy public demand for a closer look. What a responsibility, I now realized. What a situation I had saddled Hayakawa with, giving them an alarming 1 week's notice of my arrival. However horrified they might privately have been, they responded with enormous tact and hospitality. An event was organized, a reception committee was formed, cars were laid on, lunches arranged, copies of my books were found and quickly displayed on the ground floor bookstore of their corporate offices. So, I found myself headed off to the Chiyoda-ku district to meet the chef of La Riviere, a restaurant adjacent to and owned by my publisher. I was to cook a meal evocative of my earlier work of fiction for the benefit of the press, provide a few bon mots at a press conference, appear on Japanese cable TV, network also owned by my publisher, and in every way cause inconvenience to strangers who had been nothing but generous to me from afar. The chef of La Riviere, Suzuki-san, must have been thrilled to have me show up in his kitchen. Bad enough some big hairy gaijin was getting rammed down his throat, making use of his staff, rummaging through his reach-ins, but I was cooking Italian. The menu for the event was minestra toscana, followed by a paillard of veal with roasted red pepper coulis and basil oil, and a salad of arugula, endive, and radicchio. Chef Suzuki was polite as I was ushered into his kitchen with the requisite bowing and greeting. He was helpful and polite in every way, as was his crew, but he must have been simmering with rage and disgust. Suzuki-san and I communicated through a translator and gestures, my gift of a Yankee World Series champs baseball cap going only a short way to ameliorating the chef's molar-grinding distaste for what I was about to do to his kitchen. My simple Italian lunch, recreating a home-cooked meal prepared by a gangster character in the book, must have looked to the chef like roadkill. And the portions, I thought I'd scale them down nicely. But after serving the meal to a room full of bowing, chain-smoking, and very genial Hayakawa executives and a few press-ganged members of the Fourth Estate, I found myself repeatedly asked, "Bourdain-san, the portions at Le Hall, how many grams of meat in each order?" When I replied, the reaction was giggling and head-shaking, an indication I came to believe of abject terror. The prospect of returning a partially eaten entree, of not finishing, is a terrifying one, and the proper Japanese will avoid causing such offense at all costs. So the thought of tucking into a 2.5-pound côte de bœuf or a full order of cassoulet toulousain must have seemed to my hosts like scaling a mountain of dung. Still, the Hayakawa people were extremely kind. I was driven around by two senior editors, invited to lunch, with Chef Suzuki cooking this time. My second book was, I believe, rushed into print. It might otherwise have been forgotten had I not turned up on their doorstep. I got to see myself on Japanese TV and in the press. I was shown how to use the subways by Hayakawa hosts. I experienced the not unpleasant occasion of having a whole room of people bowing to me in near unison. I got to meet the elegant, shrewd, and impressive Mr. Hayakawa himself, and I signed a lot of books for persons no longer living, a first for me. Apparently, this is not an unusual practice, a commemorative signed copy for the deceased. I wasn't doing too badly by day three. My head still felt as if someone was tightening a vice around it, and I'd probably offended many at Hayakawa with my inadvertently boorish behavior. But I had been out on my own and around town. I cooked in not one but two Japanese kitchens. I was comfortably taking cabs, ordering food and drink, using mass transit, and exploring at will. I was having a good time. I was learning. Back at Le Hall, I used my recent experience at La Riviere to scale down the portions and pretty up the presentations. Working with Frederick and his crew, I rearranged plates to resemble smaller versions of what we were doing in New York, going more vertical, applying some new garnishes, and then observing customer reactions. I looked for and found ways to get more color contrast on the plates, moved the salads off to separate receptacles, stuck sprigs of herb here and there. With Frederick, I tried to develop a repertoire of specials, trying to make sense of the arcane system of supplies in Japan. Things were different here. What was ordered was not always what arrived. My inquiries about foodstuffs were often met with blank stares and shrugs. When the problem was finally identified, the answer was most often, too expensive. The supply situation really was a problem. Anglais, hanger, Côte de Bœuf, rib section, and faux filet, sirloin, were all shipped from our central boucherie in New York, so that was fine. But the bright red filet was Japanese product and wildly expensive. Fish and produce were objects of religious sanctity, particularly fish, and the price reflected that. A gift of a melon in Japan implies a life of obligation. Frites are taken very seriously in our organization, but Japanese potatoes have an unusual starch sugar content and require blanching in water. I suggested peanut oil instead of canola like we use in New York and was informed that one could rent a small apartment for what it cost to fill a deep fryer with it. I brought along some white truffle oil and some truffles, and the crew gazed at them like Martian artifacts. There was no runner or expediter at Le Hall Tokyo. After food was plated, it was hand-carried to the outer service bar where it was picked up by the waiters. The garde-manger, who also doubled as pâtissier and worked in an open area visible to the dining room, was required out of custom to shriek welcome in Japanese along with waiters, bartender, and manager to all arriving guests. This was somewhat alarming to a jet-lagged newcomer like myself. The process was repeated on departure, as it was almost everywhere I went, the ubiquitous scream of "Arigato gozaimashita" making me want to leap out of my skin. Frederick was beat. He worked 7 days a week, 14-plus hours a day, as did the general manager. It was early days for our new outpost, not yet busy enough to require a full staff, and total commitment was required. The GM's eyes seemed to float around in his skull in pools of fatigue. The cooks worked split shifts, arriving at the last possible second before service, working through lunch, then they were cut loose to wander idly around Roppongi, far from their residences, before returning for dinner. The carping and grumbling an arrangement like this would inspire back in New York would lead invariably to mutiny and open revolt. Here, people went about their tasks with considerable good cheer and dedication. The proletarian chic of Layal, New York, was something new to the Japanese. They don't really get the humble working man's fare. They adore the higher-end stuff, though, and there were unintentionally hilarious recreations of haute and nouvelle classics, fettuccine and rice on the same plate, for instance. There was, and is, a heartfelt desire to learn about French cuisine, to enjoy it. Though business has picked up enormously since my trip, at the time I was there eating at Layal with its Flintstone-sized portions and funky attitude about blood, fat, and organ meat, it was still a bold adventure. Still, I suspected it was just a matter of time. An unusual number of single women would show up for lunch, sitting alone and looking shiftily, even guiltily, about before tucking into their steaks and nibbling their frites. The female office workers looked pleasantly secretive about their brasserie encounters, as if they were involved in some deliciously dirty and forbidden conspiracy, off meeting a lover. Watching a group of Japanese salarymen tear into a cote de boeuf for two, I got the impression of a kind of gleeful social disobedience, an almost revolutionary act of convention-breaking. It was my first experience of the proper Japanese cutting loose. I would see more. I went out exploring all the time by now. The jet lag wouldn't let me sleep, so I crashed late and rose early, plunging blindly down dark streets at all hours. There is, apparently, no street crime in Tokyo. The most menacing-looking bunch of Elvis-coiffed pimps and touts would move aside wordlessly at my approach. Gaining on a group of leather-jacketed punks with silver hair and motorcycle jackets from behind, one of them would detect me and make an almost imperceptible sound, a cough or a clearing of the throat, meaning, apparently, gaijin coming through, and the crowd would part to make way. No one, and I mean no one, would meet my eye with a direct gaze. Whether standing outside a whorehouse at 4 a.m. or examining their pinky rings by an idling Yakuza limo, no one ever said, "What are you looking at?" as might have been the case in American cities under similar circumstances. Barkers for hostess bars and strip clubs and whorehouses, even the ones that accepted Westerners, never solicited me directly. I passed through them like a ghost. I walked and walked, streets full, streets empty, day and night, aimlessly in wide concentric circles, using a visible landmark to navigate around. I took subways to stops where I had no idea where I was and walked more. I ate sushi. I slurped soba noodles. I ate food off conveyor belt buffets where every imaginable dish rolled by and one simply grabbed what one wanted. I entered bars populated by only Japanese, bars for expatriates and the women who loved them. Booze was affordable and there was no tipping anywhere. I was the quiet American, the ugly American, the hungry ghost, searching and searching for whatever came next. One night at Layal, Philippe invited me out for what turned out to be the most incredible meal of my life. He'd seen by now how I was digging Tokyo. He knew from my arrival and departure times about my nocturnal wanderings, so I guess he figured I was ready. He grinned mischievously all the way. As usual, I had no idea where we were going. Philippe led me across Roppongi, crossed to the skankier, glitzier side, where the streets were choked with touts and barkers, whores and shills, video arcades, hostess bars, and love hotels. We passed by the poodle-cut pimpy boys and the heavily made-up Thai, Filipina, and Malaysian women in their platform boots and crotch-high dresses, past enormous and eerily empty Yakuza-run nightclubs, karaoke bars, restaurants. It became darker as we walked, farther and farther from the neon and screaming video signs, yet still not a rude comment or hostile stare. Finally, Philippe stopped, sniffed the air like a hunting dog, turned suddenly, and headed for a dimly lit stairwell in a deserted courtyard, a single pictogram of a leaping fish the only indicator of activity below. Down a flight of steps, not a sound, to a bare sliding door. He pushed it aside and we were standing in a small, well-lit sushi bar. Three young sushi chefs in headbands and two older men in chef's coats manned an unfinished blonde wood bar packed with somewhat inebriated-looking businessmen and their dates. We were ushered to the only two open seats, directly in front of a slowly melting monolith of carved ice, surrounded by fish and shellfish so fresh, so good-looking, it took my breath away. My chef friends in New York would have gouged out an eye or given up 5 years of their lives for the meal I was about to have. First, hot towels. Then the condiments, freshly grated wasabi, some dipping sauce. We were bought frozen sake, thick, cloudy, and utterly delicious. The first sip seemed to worm its way directly into my brain like an intoxicating ice cream headache. I had many more sips, Philippe all too anxious to pour more and more. The first tiny plate, tentacles of baby octopus, arrived, the chef standing there while we ate, examining our reactions, which were, of course, moans, smiles, bows of appreciation, and thanks. Already feeling the sake, we thanked him in French, English, and bad Japanese, covering all bases. More bows. The chef removed the plates. His hands moved, a few motions with a knife, and we were presented with the internal parts of a giant clam, still pulsating with life as it died slowly on our plates. Again the chef watched as we ate, and again we were a good audience, closing our eyes, transported. Next came abalone, with what might have been the roe and liver of something. Who cared? It was good. More sake, snapper came next, then bass, then mackerel, fresh and squeaky and lovely to look at. We went on, calling for more, our appetites beginning to attract notice from the other chefs and some of the customers who'd never, it seemed, seen anyone, especially Westerners, with our kinds of appetites. Each time the chef put another item down in front of us, I detected almost a dare, as if he didn't expect us to like what he was giving us, as if any time now he'd find something too much for our barbarian palates and crude, unsophisticated taste. No way, we went on, calling for more, more, Philippe telling the chef in halting Japanese that we were ready for anything he had. We wanted his choice. Give us your best shot, motherfucker, though I'm sure he phrased it more elegantly. The other customers began to melt away, and our hosts, the chef joined by an assistant now, seemed impressed with our zeal, the blissed-out looks on our faces, our endless capacity for more, more, more. Another clam arrived, this one tiny, more roes, some baby flounder. It kept coming, accompanied by pickled wasabi stem. Seaweed so fresh I could taste deep ocean water. Another tiny moist towel was provided in a little basket, and Philippe informed me that custom allowed us to eat with our hands at this point in the meal. Tuna arrived, from the belly, from the loin. We kept grinning, kept bowing, kept eating. Our sakes were refilled, the chef openly smiling now. These crazy gaijin wanted it all, baby. The best course yet arrived, a quickly grilled, halved fish head. The chef watched us curious, I imagine, to see how we deal with this new development. It was unbelievable. Every crevice, every scrap of this sweet, delicate Dorade or Chilean pompano, I didn't know from looking at the partly charred face, and by now didn't much care, had responded differently to the heat of the grill. From the fully cooked remnant of body behind the head, to the crispy skin and cartilage, the tender, translucently rare cheeks, it was a mosaic of distinct flavors and textures. And the eye, oh yeah, we dug out the orbs, slurped down the gelatinous matter behind it, deep in the socket, we gnawed the eyeball down to a hard white core. When we were done with this collage of good stuff, when we'd fully picked over every tiny flake and scrap, there was nothing left but teeth and a few bones. Were we finished? No way. More sashimi, more sushi, some tiger shrimp, what looked like herring, so fresh it crunched. I didn't care what they put in front of me anymore. I trusted the smiling chef and his crew. I was going along for the full ride. More frozen sake, more food. The last few customers got up and lurched to the door, like us, red-faced and perspiring from the booze. We continued. There had to be something we hadn't tried yet. I was beginning to think that some of the cooks were calling their homes by now, telling their families, get in here and get a load of these gaijins. They're eating everything in the store. After course 20 or so, the chef slit, brushed, dabbed, and formed the final course, a piece of raw sea eel. Earthenware cups of green tea were delivered. Finally, we were done. We left to the usual bows and screams of arigato gozaimashimashita and picked our way carefully, very carefully, up the stairs, back to the physical world. I left Philippe at Leal, had a couple of cocktails at an empty faux Irish pub, and staggered back to my apartment. I had to get up early for the fish market. Tsukiji, Tokyo's central fish market, puts New York's Fulton Street to shame. It's bigger, better, and unlike its counterpart in Manhattan, a destination worth visiting, if only to gape. I arrived by taxi at 4:30 in the morning. The colors of the market alone seemed to burn my retinas. The variety, the strangeness, the sheer volume of seafood available at Tsukiji amounted to a colossal terror dome of mind-boggling dimensions. The simple awareness that the seafood-crazy Japanese were raking, dredging, netting, and hooking that much stuff out of the sea each day gave me pause. A Himalayan-sized mountain of discarded styrofoam fish boxes announced my arrival, as well as a surrounding rabbit warren of shops, breakfast joints, and merchants servicing the market. The market itself was enclosed, stretching seemingly into infinity under a hangar-type roof, and I will tell you that my life as a chef will never be the same again after spending the morning and subsequent mornings there. Scallops and snowshoe-sized black shells lay atop crushed ice, fish still flopping, twitching, and struggling in pans of water, spitting at me as I walked down the first of many narrow corridors between the vendors' stands. Things were different here in that the Japanese market workers had no compunction about looking you in the eye, even nudging you out of the way. They were busy. Space was limited, and moving product around in between sellers, buyers, dangerously careening forklifts, gawking tourists, and about a million tons of seafood was tough. The scene was riotous. Eels, pinned to boards by a spike through the head, were filleted alive. Workers cut loins of tuna off the bone in two-man teams, lopping off perfect hunks with truly terrifying-looking swords and saws, which, mishandled, could easily have halved their partners. Periwinkles, cockles, encyclopedic selections of roes, salted, pickled, cured, and fresh, were everywhere. Fish still bent from rigor mortis, porgy, sardines, swordfish, abalone, spiny lobsters, giant lobsters, blowfish, bonito, bluefin, yellowfin. Tuna was sold like gems, displayed in light boxes and illuminated from below, little labels indicating grade and price. Tuna was king. It was fresh, dried, cut, number one, number two, vendors who specialized in the less lovely bits. There were hundreds, maybe thousands, of gigantic bluefin and bonito blast-frozen on faraway factory ships. Frost-covered 200 to 300 pounders were stacked everywhere, like stone figures on Easter Island, a single slice taken from near the tail so quality could be examined. They were laid out in rows, built up in a heap, sawed into redwood-like sections, still frozen, hauled about on forklifts. There were sea urchins, egg sacs, fish from all over the world. Giant squid as long as an arm and baby squid the size of a thumbnail shared space with whitebait, smelts, what looked like worms, slugs, snails, crabs, mussels, shrimp, and everything else that grew, swam, skittered, clawed, crawled, snaked, or clung near the ocean floor. Unlike the low-tide reek of Fulton, Tsukiji smelled hardly at all. What scent it had was not of fish, but of seawater and the cigarettes of the fishmongers. I had never seen or even imagined many of the creatures I saw. Hungry, I pushed into a nearby stall, the Japanese version of Rosie's Diner, a place packed with rubber-booted market workers eating breakfast. The signs were entirely in Japanese, with no helpful pictures, but a friendly fishmonger took charge. What arrived was, of course, flawless. Here I was in the Tokyo version of a greasy spoon, surrounded by a mob of tough-looking bastards in dripping boots and the requisite New York-style rude waitress, and the food was on a par with the best of my hometown. Fresh, clean, beautifully, if simply presented. Soon I was wolfing down sushi, miso soup, a tail section of braised fish in sauce, and an impressive array of pickles. Beats 2 eggs over. I loaded up with cockles and squid for the restaurant, bought some knives for my sous chef back in New York, and head-aching, stopped off at Akasuka Temple, where the ailing apparently waft incense smoke over their afflicted parts. The smoke did nothing for my head. I bought aspirin, which incongruously came with free candy and pamphlets advertising patent medicines, and took a taxi to Kapabashi, Tokyo's Bowery. It was the perfect metaphor for Tokyo. Ringing up some wine glasses, cocktail shakers, tablecloth clips, and cake molds, the clerk at the restaurant supply store added up my bill on an abacus, but computed the tax on a calculator. I was really beginning to worry about my head when I finally bumped into Philippe again at the restaurant. "Can this still be jet lag?" I asked him. "The pain seemed to be aspirin-proof. Am I dying?" "Oh, you mean the helmet," he asked, circling his own head with his fingers to indicate the exact location of the pain. He shrugged. "C'est normal." It's never a good thing when a Frenchman says, "C'est normal." I knew he'd been up early, too. I'd heard him knocking around his room as I left for the fish market. Here it was, 7 at night. As usual, I was starting to fade, my English degenerating into monosyllables, experiencing hot flashes, sweats, and chills. I asked Philippe, hopefully, if he'd had a nap since the morning. He looked so damn fresh, crisp and debonair in a smartly cut suit, positively rosy-cheeked, and in the middle of some Byzantine accounting and scheduling problem which would have caused me difficulty when my faculties were at their peak. "Oh, no," he said cheerfully. "When I'm in Tokyo, I don't sleep much. I just take my vitamins and go." The following night was my last in Tokyo. Philippe took me out to a shabu-shabu joint in Shibuya, Tokyo's Times Square. It was Friday night, and all the painstakingly observed customs and practices of the workday went out the window. The streets were packed with herds of insanely drunk businessmen and teenagers. In Tokyo, it's apparently okay, even de rigueur, to go out with the boss and the boys from the office and get completely stuttering, out-of-control drunk. In such circumstances, after a night of drinking and karaoke, it's okay to vomit on your boss's shoes, take a swing at him, call him an asshole. He'll probably throw you over his shoulders and carry you home. Everybody was drunk. Everywhere, lovely young women brushed the hair out of their violently heaving boyfriends' faces as they leaned on all fours into the gutters. Suit-and-tied salarymen projectile vomited, lurched, sang, caroused, and staggered like bumper cars down the humanity-clogged streets. Mobs of people surged in never-ending waves toward Shibuya Station to meet friends and lovers by the statue of a dog. The dog, it was explained to me, had continued to show up every day at the station long after its master had died. That kind of dedication impresses the Japanese, and a statue is erected in the pooch's honor. It's one of the most popular meeting places in the city. Nearby, the narrow, neon-lit streets swam with more nightclubs, bars, restaurants, screaming, building-high video screens whose exhortations made my molars shake like tuning forks. We found a shabu-shabu joint, a crowded tatami room where there were no other Westerners, and managed to contort our limbs under and around the low table. A big wok filled with broth was heated up for us, and a uniformed attendant arrived with an Everest-high heap of meat, vegetables, seafood, and noodles. We kicked off the meal with hot sake, heated with grilled fish bones. The fish oil that collected on top was ignited before drinking, and the flavor was heavily aromatic, with fumes that seemed to penetrate brain tissue immediately. Item by item, according to cooking time, the food was added to the oil like a giant fondue. When everything had been deposited in the wok, we were left to our own devices, save frequent refills of chilled sake. I did not want to leave. I had only begun to eat. There were a million restaurants, bars, temples, back alleys, nightclubs, neighborhoods, and markets to explore. Fully feeling the effects of the sake, I was seriously considering burning my passport, trading my jeans and leather jacket for a dirty seersucker suit, and disappearing into the exotic East. This was excitement, romance, adventure, and there was so much more of it, too much more of it, for even another month, another year, another decade to adequately contain my investigations. I knew I could live here now. I'd learned a few things, not much, but enough to negotiate traffic, feed myself, get drunk, get around town. I pictured myself as a character like Green Scobie in Africa, or the narrator of The Quiet American in Saigon, even Kurtz in Heart of Darkness, my head swimming with all sorts of romantically squalid notions. At 2 o'clock in the morning, the streets still swarming with young Japanese and American sports cars, girls sitting on the back of convertibles, gangsters and whores emerging from nightclubs, moving on to the next place, shirtless gaijins howling at the moon from upstairs whorehouses, I staggered down dark back streets, hit some more bars, and finding myself incongruously hungry again and wanting to soak up some of the sea of alcohol in my stomach, committed the ultimate in Tokyo faux pas. I ate a McDonald's hamburger while I walked. The trains shut down at 11:30, and most of Tokyo, it seemed, preferred to stay out all night to taking a taxi. One could, Philippe had explained before leaving me off at Roppongi Crossing, borrow money to get home from almost any policeman if drunk and unexpectedly short of funds. The idea of not returning the next day to repay the debt was, in typically Japanese thinking, unthinkable. I walked unsteadily for hours, stopped off for a final drink, managed somehow to get back to my apartment and call Nancy. She laid on some fresh bialys from Columbia Bagels and some Krispy Kreme donuts for my return. I began packing. So you want to be a chef, a commencement address. For culinary students, line cooks looking to move up in the world, newcomers to the business, and the otherwise unemployables who make up so much of our workforce, I have a few nuggets of advice. The boiled-down wisdom of 25 years of doing right and doing wrong in the restaurant industry. For the growing number of people who are considering becoming a professional chef as a second career, I have some advice, too. In fact, let's dispose of you first. So you want to be a chef. You really, really, really want to be a chef. If you've been working in another line of business, have been accustomed to working 8 to 9 hour days, weekends and evenings off, holidays with the family, regular sex with your significant other, if you are used to being treated with some modicum of dignity, spoken to and interacted with as a human being, seen as an equal, a sensitive, multidimensional entity with hopes, dreams, aspirations, and opinions, the sort of qualities you'd expect of most working persons, then maybe you should reconsider what you'll be facing when you graduate from whatever 6-month course put this nonsense in your head to start with. I wasn't kidding when I said earlier that, at least in the beginning, you have no rights, are not entitled to an opinion or a personality, and can fully expect to be treated as cattle, only less useful. Believe it. I wish I had a dollar for every well-meaning career changer who attended a 6-month course and showed up to be an extern in my kitchen. More often than not, one look at what they would really be spending their first few months doing, one look at what their schedule would be, and they ran away in terror. To those serious ones who know what it is they are entering, who are fully prepared, ready, willing, and able, and committed to a career path like, say, Scott Bryan's, who want to be chefs, must be chefs, whatever the personal costs and physical demands, that I have this to say to you. Welcome to my world. And consider these suggestions as to your conduct, attitude, and preparation for the path you intend to follow. Number one, be fully committed. Don't be a fence-sitter or a waffler. If you're going to be a chef someday, be sure about it. Single-minded in your determination to achieve victory at all costs. If you think you might find yourself standing in a cellar prep kitchen one day after tourneying 200 potatoes, wondering if you made the right move, or some busy night on a grill station find yourself doubting the wisdom of your chosen path, then you will be a liability to yourself and others. You are, for all intents and purposes, entering the military. Ready yourself to follow orders, give orders when necessary, and live with the outcome of those orders without complaint. Be ready to lead, follow, or get out of the way. 2. Learn Spanish. I can't stress this enough. Much of the workforce in the industry you are about to enter is Spanish-speaking. The very backbone of the industry, whether you like it or not, is inexpensive Mexican, Dominican, Salvadoran, and Ecuadorian labor, most of whom could cook you under the table without breaking a sweat. If you can't communicate, develop relationships, understand instructions, and pass them along, then you are at a tremendous disadvantage. Should you become a leader, Spanish is absolutely essential. Also, learn as much as you can about the distinct cultures, histories, and geographies of Mexico, El Salvador, Ecuador, and the Dominican Republic. A cook from Puebla is different in background from a cook from Mexico City. Somebody who fled El Salvador to get away from the Mano Blanco is not likely to get along with the right-wing Cuban working next to him. These are your co-workers, your friends, the people you will be counting on, leaning on for much of your career, and they in turn will be looking to you to hold up your end. Show them some respect by bothering to know them, learn their language, eat their food. It will be personally rewarding and professionally invaluable. Number 3, don't steal. In fact, don't do anything that you couldn't take a polygraph test over. If you're a chef who drinks too many freebies at the bar, takes home the occasional steak for the wife, or smokes Hawaiian bud in the off hours, be fully prepared to admit this unapologetically to any and all. Presumably, your idiosyncrasies will, on balance, make you no less a chef to your employers and employees. If you're a sneak and a liar, however, it will follow you forever. This is a small business. Everybody knows everybody else. You will do yourself immeasurable harm. Don't ever take kickbacks or bribes from a purveyor. They'll end up owning you, and you will have sold off your best assets as a chef, your honesty, reliability, and integrity, in a business where these are frequently rare and valuable qualities. Temptation, of course, is everywhere. When you're a hungry, underpaid line cook, those filet mignon you're searing off by the dozens look mighty good. Pilfer one, and you're bent. Ask for one, for Christ's sake. You'll probably get one. If they won't let you have one, you're probably working in the wrong place. Faking petty cash vouchers, stealing food, colluding with a purveyor or a co-worker is extraordinarily easy. Avoid it, really. I was bent for the first half of my career, meaning I pilfered food, turned in the occasional inflated petty cash slip, nicked beer for the kitchen. It didn't feel good. Slinking home at the end of the night, knowing that you're a thief, whatever your excuse, my boss is a thief, I need the money, they'll never notice, feels lousy, and it can come back to bite you later in your career. Recently, I agreed to meet with a representative from a major seafood wholesaler. I met him at the empty bar of my restaurant during the slow time between lunch and dinner and told him that I'd done business with his company at another restaurant. I was inclined to like the company. The products and services had, in my experience so far, been first rate. And what he needed to do to get my business was simply provide the same or better quality fish as my other purveyors, and do so at a lower price. I meant it, too. I am absolutely tone-deaf to criminal solicitation. It bores me. And for all my misbehavior over the years, I have never, and I mean never, taken money or a thing of value from a purveyor in return for my master's business. Junior, that was his name, from X Seafood, seemed puzzled by my apparent obtuseness that day. Thick-necked, crew-cutted, but oh-so-friendly, Junior seemed to think that maybe we were talking about sex, when in fact all the while we were discussing the internal combustion engine. There were long silences as his gentle, cheerful probings and expressions of non-specific goodwill were left dangling in the air. After a while of this, me wanting only to know how much he was charging for Norwegian salmon today, and resisting his unspoken entreaties suddenly to muse aloud about how maybe it would be nice if I could afford a hot tub for my apartment, he gave up in frustration and left. Minutes later, a waiter drew my attention to a plain white envelope on the floor. Opening it, I found a stack of $100 bills and a list of nearby hotels and restaurants with some names checked off. Junior had apparently dropped it. I have to tell you, I felt pretty damn good calling up Senior down at X Seafood and breezily informing him that his son seemed to have left something behind by mistake at my restaurant. Could they please send someone to come pick it up? A red-faced functionary picked the envelope up within minutes, and I never heard from that company again. All sorts of scumbags will offer you every variety of free stuff if you entertain the prospect of doing business with them, slipping them food, or looking the other way. Screw them all. Don't even play footsie with them, meaning, I'll take the case of Dom, but I don't know if I can always do business with you. Don't even do that. There are a lot of scumbags in the restaurant business, people who will let the Gambino family decide who gets the fish order or the liquor order in return for Nick's tickets or a lap dance. And these are people who you will have to deal with, sometimes adversarially. How can you win an argument with one of these people when you're a scumbag too? 4. Always be on time. 5. Never make excuses or blame others. 6. Never call in sick, except in cases of dismemberment, arterial bleeding, sucking chest wounds, or the death of an immediate family member. Granny died, bury her on your day off. 7. Lazy, sloppy, and slow are bad. Enterprising, crafty, and hyperactive are good. 8. Be prepared to witness every variety of human folly and injustice, without it screwing up your head or poisoning your attitude. You will simply have to endure the contradictions and inequities of this life. Why does that brain-damaged, lazy-ass busboy take home more money than me, the goddamn sous chef? Should not be a question that drives you to tears of rage and frustration. It will just be like that sometimes. Accept it. Why is he/she treated better than me? How come the chef gets to loiter in the dining room playing kissy face with insert minor celebrity here while I'm working my ass off? Why is my hard work and dedication not sufficiently appreciated? These are all questions best left unasked. The answers will drive you insane eventually. If you keep asking yourself questions like these, you will find yourself slipping into martyr mode, unemployment, alcoholism, drug addiction, and death. 9. Assume the worst about everybody. But don't let this poisoned outlook affect your job performance. Let it all roll off your back. Ignore it. Be amused by what you see and suspect. Just because someone you work with is a miserable, treacherous, self-serving, capricious, and corrupt asshole shouldn't prevent you from enjoying their company, working with them, or finding them entertaining. This business grows assholes. It's our principal export. I'm an asshole. You should probably be an asshole, too. 10. Try not to lie. Remember, this is the restaurant business. No matter how bad it is, everybody probably has heard worse. Forget to place the produce order. Don't lie about it. You made a mistake. Admit it and move on. Just don't do it again. Ever. 11. Avoid restaurants where the owner's name is over the door. Avoid restaurants that smell bad. Avoid restaurants with names that would look funny or pathetic on your resume. 12. Think about that resume. How will it look to the chef weeding through a stack of faxes if you've never worked in one place longer than 6 months? If the years 95 to 97 are unaccounted for? If you worked as sandwich chef at Happy Malone's Cheerful Chicken, maybe you shouldn't mention that. And please, if you appeared as Bud in a daytime soap opera, played the narrator in a summer stock production of Our Town, leave it off the resume. Nobody cares, except the chef, who won't be hiring anyone with delusions of thespian greatness. Under reasons for leaving last job, never give the real reason unless it's money or ambition. 13. Read. Read cookbooks, trade magazines. I recommend Food Arts, Savour, restaurant business magazines. They're useful for staying abreast of industry trends and for pinching recipes and concepts. Some awareness of the history of your business is useful, too. It allows you to put your own miserable circumstances in perspective when you've examined and appreciated the full sweep of culinary history. Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London is invaluable, as is Nicholas Freeling's The Kitchen, David Bloom's Flash in the Pan, The Batterbury's Fine Account of American Restaurant History on the Town in New York, and Joseph Mitchell's Up in the Old Hotel. Read the old masters, Escoffier, Bacuse et al., as well as the young Turks, Keller, Marco Pierre White, and more recent generations of innovators and craftsmen. 14, have a sense of humor about things. You'll need it. Kitchen's closed. My hands hurt. My feet hurt too, sticking out from under the covers, radiating pain up to the knees. Sunday morning at 8 o'clock, and I'm lying in bed after a king hell, bone-crushing Saturday night at Leal, making noises no human should ever make. Just getting my Zippo to light takes 3 tries with unresponsive fingers, a few muttered curses. I'm psyching myself up for the